All right, guys, before we begin, I just want to make sure that you understand that I have a microphone that's going to be doing this sort of thing, you know, going up and down, because I can't find the mic stand. I'm not in my house. And I don't know why. I just want you to know that it's not going to last the entire time. It's just a little bit of the intro there. And on with the show. All right? It won't be the whole time. Happy holidays. Hey everybody, welcome back to Classical Guitar Insider. It's your host, Brett Williams. Today's show is sponsored by CasperTrial.com/insider. That's CasperTrial.com/insider. You can go there and you can get a couple of dollars off a mattress. I'm not sure how much. I think it's 50. You'll find out. It's CasperTrial.com/insider. You'll find out about how much you get off when you go there and look it up. But I think it's $50 off a mattress. I'm pretty sure. I'm not going to look it up. I'd rather not. Please don't make me. CasperTrial.com/insider to help out the show. It really does help. So if you're in the market for a new mattress, and I think most people are, I think most people have sort of, something happened. You know, it's the summer happened. You know what? I don't think people buy mattresses in the winter because the smells aren't there. That's what I'm going to go out on a limb and say that that's the case. You know, things kind of cool down. You don't sweat in it. It's not getting hot. You're like, oh, it's a pretty good mattress. And then the summer comes around and it's a swamp, you know, just swimming in the yeast that your body has created. That's CasperTrial.com/insider for $50 off a mattress. Also sponsored, of course, and as always, and as lovingly as possible by SavageClassical.com. That's all you got to do. SAVAGE classical.com for all your classical guitar needs. You go there and the warmest, most cuddliest teddy bear in the world will sell you a guitar for a reasonable price in Bayshore, New York, or online. You can order and return the guitar if you don't like it. That's SavageClassical.com, the best guitar store in the world. No doubt about it. I'm just going through the sponsors today because we have Michael Pohl is going to be joining me before I speak to Peter Argondiza. And Michael Pohl, like Peter did before, is now living in England and is an American expatriate. So unbeknownst to me, I now have a show that's completely devoted to Americans that decided to relocate to England. Peter did it for many, many years, and he tells us all about that in the second part of this show. And Michael Pohl is going to be coming on to talk about his Kickstarter for his new project, which is seven string guitar, a recording of Bach on seven string guitar. It sounds beautiful. There's a great video that accompanies it that you can go to on his website, I think, and he talks about the way that you can help him out. You know, just throw a couple of dollars at him. That's his Kickstarter. And I'll be talking to him. But before we talk to him, there's a lot of places I want you to go. So you can pick one. But I think for this episode, we're going to say Michael Pohl is the way to go, unless you're hurting for a new mattress or a BarkBoxTrial.com/insider box for the holidays. You can get a box for your friend. You can get if you have a friend with a dog, you got one of those, you know, single friends or something, or like a dysfunctional family that thought that a dog would save them. You know, you can send them something for their dog so their dog gets a little bit of love from an outsider. Have you ever thought about that for Christmas or for Hanukkah or for whatever it is you celebrate? I don't know all the other holidays. I'm not a religious person, so I end up not necessarily I lose interest in the holidays of other cultures, because every time I look them up I get a little bit disappointed. And I'm not trying to be offensive, but every time I'm like, what are we celebrating today? It's they're like, well, this is the day that the horn was blown inside of the cavern when the people of Egypt were being they were in a hole. And the trumpet was sounded, and that's how the people knew they were free. And I'm like, well, great, this happened a couple of years. No, it happened 16,000 years ago. And so for me, I'm always just a little bit like, I love that people are happy and that we're celebrating something. I'm not big on the why. I know all about the whys from the Christian point of view because that's the way I was raised. I try to learn a little bit about Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah and stuff like that, but I always forget because I just it's just not my thing. Sorry, is that okay to say? Is it okay to say it's just not my thing? I think that's all right. Anyway, the show is if you're not forming a hateful email to me right now. You can get on your computer and you can go ahead and you can send, you can donate to my site too, if you want. That's just brettwilliamsmusic.com. But you know, let's get the money to Michael Pohl this week. Huh? Let's get it. You know, the way Kickstarter works is that if you don't hit the mark, you don't get the money. Everybody's money's returned to them. So we got to help this kid out. He's a good guy. But don't let that stop you from going to audibletrial.com/insight. audibletrial.com/insider. Did I already talk about that? You can get a free audiobook download of your choice and a 30-day free trial on me, not us. This is all me, this show. I do everything. I used to say us. I was like, why am I saying us? Like I'm some big operation. I got to make you guys think there's three of us. Anyway, that's enough of that. You can go to BarkBoxTrial.com/insider, CasperTrial.com/insider, AudibleTrial.com/insider, SavageClassical.com, any one of those. And, you know, go to Michael Pohl's website and help him out. In the meantime, here's my conversation with Michael Pohl. Please keep the hateful email to a minimum. I respect religions. I want to say that. I work for a religious institution. I work for a great Jewish school. It's amazing. I have many loved ones. I celebrate the holidays. You know, I don't want to go further than that. All right, you guys. Take it easy. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah to everybody. It's been a real honor, you know, having another year of Classical Guitar Insider. Be listened to by so many people, and I appreciate all your support and all your nice emails and all the donations and everything. I guess it's the end of the year, so if you're going to donate now, right? I don't know how taxes work. I don't know if you'll be able to write it off. It just says donate. I know that I get taxed on the income, so I don't know all that stuff. Well, you know, if you did that, I could what? I'm not making that much money in donations, unfortunately. But anyway, so let's get on. Here's Michael Pohl.
Yes.
And you're English.
No, I'm actually American.
Are you?
I grew up in the States. I ended up with a grant to go to Poland to study with Łukasz Kurapaczewski and his teacher, Piotr Zaleski. And then I met the conductor, Chris Hogwood.
I love Christopher Hogwood. I love that. I just was listening to him like the other day. I was listening to his Vivaldi.
He's a great.
I forget who the violinist is, Monica something. But he's seriously my favorite, you know, Baroque early music conductor, I think, for sure. So you met him?
I met him in Poznan since he was in town to conduct the orchestra. And then it just happened by chance that he said, isn't there anything you can do in London? I said, there's nothing for me in London. What am I going to do? He said, apply for something. And so I did, and then I got lucky. I got a grant from the British government, from the Marshall Aid Commemoration Commission, to do a master's at Guildhall, and I've been here ever since.
You've been where? You're in London now?
Oh, in London, yep.
Okay, so you are in London now, because you seem to... I mean, is it just me, or is it... Maybe it's just the promo video that I saw for your project, but, you know, you had an English lady in the background, which is always a really good touch when you're doing promotional videos for anything.
So I had these incredible, incredible guys who made this video for me for fun. It was a pet project for them. They both loved music, both the operator and the director. And at the end of it, they're pros, so they insisted we wake up incredibly early in the morning. So we started at 4 a.m. Because that's when it's quietest and they can be sure to catch the early morning light. But it meant I had very little sleep the night before. And so, you know, when it came time to talk about the project, they interviewed me. And somewhere that got left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah, you don't talk at all. So I had no idea. I didn't know where you were from. And you know, you seem to have some sort of an accent. You seem like there's something going on there. Is that just from being there for a while? Or how long you been there?
I've been here for 5 years. And
There's something happening. You're changing. You're changing. You're going Madonna on us right now.
I don't mean to. I heard it happening in musician friends who are a few years ahead of me in terms of they're Americans who came to live here, and their sentence cadence changed. I couldn't believe it. I thought they were putting me on, but I think it just happens naturally over time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you almost sound like Irish to me.
Oh, weird. I was talking to an Irishman earlier this morning, so maybe it's rubbed off on me. Oh, I think 100%. That when I go back to the States, when I spend enough time in the States, that. That it comes back, that my American thing, you know, gets back in action.
So 5 years you've been doing it. This is a straight up. Sorry, the phone's buzzing. I don't know who that is. I'm sure it's nobody important, but it's not you, right? You're not calling.
Nope. It's not
okay.
Me.
So as far as you know, going there, you said you were studying. I kind of lost track a little bit, but you met Christopher Hogwood. And now you're in England. And now the current project that you're working on involves 7-string guitar, right?
Yeah.
Which is I don't know. Is the 8-string more? That happens more often than 7-string. Is that right? I don't know. Am I wrong about this? I can't remember because I've always just played the same guitar.
I don't know either. To be honest, what happened to me with the 7 is that. I became really interested in being able to play lower notes because of the Bach suites.
Right.
You know,
play them in the original key then?
Well, not always. Some of them. I play the E major in E major, although there's a really interesting thing about that people don't talk about so much, which is that might have been a transposing score because the E lute was not really a thing. On the other hand, people would change lutes the way they change... crooks in a trumpet or the way they or crooks in a natural horn, or they change natural trumpets with the length of the barrel. And so there's a possibility that even though E major wasn't a key that it would have sounded in, that he wrote it in E major, intended it for a transposing lute. So this whole question of key is very...
It's like, yeah, I mean, it's really, what it comes down to is, who cares?
But when he arranged, he almost always changed key. So if you think about it, there's one of the violin
partitas.
The violin sonatas harpsichord. One of the partita is the one that we have, the E major, and that's the only one. It's the only thing for which he doesn't change the explicit key, which is what makes me think that maybe he was intending it to be transposed. So there's a helicopter going by. I hope it's not too loud.
No, that's fine. There's a massive building being built next to me. So there's all sorts of fun noises for people to enjoy. There's environmental ambiance.
But the exciting thing about the project for me was that I was really excited to do something on the guitar where we could play the pitches in terms of the bass notes that Bach wrote for the lute. And I thought, you know, oh my gosh, you know, it means I'm going to have to do something like Joran Socher did with the you know, I can't remember, is it 11 or 12 strings?
I don't know.
That he does. there's an incredible album for Deutsche Grammophon that he has. And then there's, of course, Stefan Schmidt, who has 8. And I thought that was going to be, but then I went through the scores, you know, and it was saying, I really think you could do this on 7. And you can. I understand now in retrospect why people do it with 8.
Yeah.
But 7, you can cover the notes with one very small exception in the G minor suite. Yeah. There's one spot where you have to make a bit of a concession to get around an inner voice. But other than that, it's all possible.
Yeah, and you felt, I mean, it does sound, it sounds good. It sounds like, you know, like a... it sounds like a Nigel North recording or something. You know, it sounds like something. It sounds warm, and it's got that extra string feel to it. So it's a good and the video is really beautiful. Like you said, your friends did it for free, which is crazy nowadays that people can just push that out so easily. But as far as the project, how are you? I mean, you reached out to me. You're financing the project right now with a Kickstarter. Is that right?
Yeah, so I had the idea that it would be incredible to do it at a at such an iconic studio like Abbey Road. Obviously,
that's great. I mean, it's crazy. How do you even do that? I mean, that's amazing. So it's going to be recorded at Abbey Road, or it has been recorded, and now you're.
No, not, it hasn't been recorded yet. It's more expensive because of all of the professionals who are involved and because of the equipment of the studio and these sorts of things. And I'm working on being able to do it in 3D sound. So if you turn your head, that, you know, it could be used in a more complicated environment, so that if you turned your head, that the sound would then be louder on your left, and these sorts of this is not ready for prime time yet, but it's something that's coming on the horizon. It's what the new connector in the Apple phones is about. It's
about 3D sound, really.
Yeah, so that they can get more bandwidth of sound back and forth between not just sound, but also information that goes with the sound.
Yeah, that's it. So you're doing all sorts of stuff with it, and that is gonna set you back. And so people need to help you out, right?
it's great. It's a dream of mine to do this kind of project. It's a dream to be at a place like Abbey Road, and it's super expensive. And also, as people know, it's become a more challenging landscape to sell recordings. You know, people expect it for free on the internet and all these sorts of things. So I really need the help ahead of time to try to make it possible.
Yeah, I think that's where people sometimes lose it, is they think they're going to be able to sell the recordings. You and I sort of talked about that over email, that getting it ahead of time, getting people excited about the project, making them feel like they're part of it. And then, at least that's what I did with my last project. And it seemed to work. That's the only time I made any money off it, was just sort of getting people excited about the idea of something new happening. And I think that's what we're going for here. Right, Mike?
Absolutely. I mean, you had a smarter project than I am. I don't think I'll earn any money on the front end. But it's... The great thing about it is it's not just the idea of being involved. You know, people are literally making it happen, and I've been sort of overcome by how generous people have been in getting this far. I mean, the project is over halfway, and there are I think 12 days left at this point. By the time that this goes into podcast land, it'll probably be a few fewer days.
Yeah, well, I'll try and push it out a little early if I can. I mean, I released the last one late, so maybe I'll throw it up a little earlier. How about that?
How about that? Paying back the listeners for the time they went.
Right, for my latency. So let's where can they go to help you out?
So if you go onto Kickstarter, you can just search for my name. It's, as you said, Michael Poll. Poll, like voting poll.
Yeah, Michael, P-O-L-L.
P-O-L-L. And if you just search it on Google, it's Michael Poll Kickstarter. It'll come up the first thing. There's also, if you type my name into Google, it'll through the website, and then through the website, you can trace it down that way. But I'd try to give you a link, but it's such a law, you know.
No, yeah, you're being smart about that. That's when people try to give people the link. I think the old-timers always try to do that. They're always like, oh, go to www, and I'm like, just calm down. They'll Google you. But as far, Michael Poll guitar ought to do the trick too, you know, if people want to do that.
Yes,
that'll usually work. That way they can misspell your name.
Yes, exactly. Hopefully. I haven't tried that.
You haven't tried? Oh, give it a shot. Yeah, Google yourself. Who doesn't Google themselves?
Misspelling my own name. Yeah, I've tried it with, you know, how do you spell your own name? But I've never tried it. Like, what happens if you get the name close?
I don't know. I always try to say one T, because Brett with two T's is a rock Christian singer from the 70s. So when I first got started, I was really, I was nervous about getting confused with him. And some people really did go like, oh, you know, I didn't know you did country music. And I was like, no, I don't do that. And now I'm actually the guy who's part of, you know, Woodchuck, the apple cider company.
Yeah.
Like the alcoholic apple cider. So it's me and him for Brett Williams. It's me and him back and forth. He's like the guy who owns a company or something. So anyway, Michael, that's great. So again, they can go to, just Michael Poll on Kickstarter and help out the project. And again, folks, this is the way that, that we're doing this now. This is the only way we can make money, or not make money. I mean, you're recording at Abbey Road Studio. That's going to be the overhead. So this is just a dream of yours. And not only that, but you are a great player, and they can see the promotional video on your website, I'm sure too, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And on Kickstarter.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. And that link is weird, so we won't give them all the T's and X's and Y's and Z's that go with that. All right, Michael. Well, it was great meeting you. Stay warm out there. And when are you coming back home?
I don't know. I should be there in the spring. Hopefully, it's not.
No, you're not going home for the old holiday, huh?
No, I'll miss it. Unfortunately.
Oh, they're gonna be mad at you.
Yeah, I'll be in the doghouse. But
that's the way it's life. Well, Christmas in London sounds spectacular.
Yeah, it should be lovely.
Okay, buddy, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, and thanks so much for having me.
No problem, Michael.
All right, folks, why don't you go ahead and pause before we go on to my interview with Peter Argonditza. Make sure that you donate to Michael Pohl's Kickstarter so that we can have a wonderful new take on the works of Johann Sebastian Bach. All right, on with the show.
Let's start from the beginning, because there's a lot. It seems like there's a lot with you. You seem like you're a rich and colorful person. Is that fair to say?
I've been around, yes.
You've been around. Yeah,
I've been
how long have you been? How long have you been around? Do you mind saying that?
Or I mean, I'm past my fifth decade.
You're past your fifth decade.
Yes.
How does it feel? I'm pushing my fourth right now. Yeah. I'm about to be my fourth in February.
Getting into the fifth decade was the hard one. I do remember when I turned 50, and that was I remember that birthday and the. Thinking this was some weird milestone, and that one day was hard. But after that, you know, I got so wrapped up in with my kids and, you know, working and teaching and trying to put on concerts and other such things that just things just sort of moved forward. And, you know, ultimately it's just a number. I mean, I don't feel like I'm past 50. I feel quite, you know, youthful in terms of the way I think about things, though responsibilities do build up, and you have to be realistic about that. So it's the body sometimes tells you different stories that you are the age that you are.
Right, but, can't walk.
Yeah,
all of a sudden I can't walk.
I remember your foot stories on some of your the podcast.
Oh, that was Michael Chaplin. That was him.
Okay.
Yeah. So he showed up at my house a day early.
Oh, right.
Which I don't even know if we talked about it, but he wouldn't mind me talking about it. He showed up at my house like a day early, and I was like, well, I'm at the, you know, doctor to get my foot looked at. Which your foot is something that only happens past the age of, I would assume, 34.
Yeah.
I would assume. I don't know.
Was that the mark for you?
What do you got? What kind of problems do you got?
I'm actually remarkably healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not in shape. A couple of years ago, I took up running a lot, and I actually did run in a marathon. Completed a marathon.
Oh, cool.
Okay, and it was when I was living in Scotland, and they had the Edinburgh Marathon.
I'm sorry, this is past 50?
This was past 50. My goal was to try to do a marathon before I turned 60, and my family started saying, "Well, you better get on the ball, Peter." You know, so I trained, and also it was a great opportunity. I had the great thing about running marathons or running half marathons, and they have them here in New York, is you can have people sponsor you, you can raise money for good causes, and that particular year, my eldest daughter was graduating from high school and was going to Peru to do some charity work and for a year and to work in an orphanage. And she needed to raise money to get there and live there. And so I used that as a chance to raise so I could sponsor that. So I raised a little bit of money for her. So it was not only to get in shape and to see if I could actually do it, but to also, you know, to help raise her money. And it was a great thing because if anybody had told me in my 20s that I would be even running a mile, I would have said, you're absolutely crazy. And one thing I learned from that, which is something I think about when you're asking me about age, and I think about my position as what I am as a guitarist and learning and the different shifts you have to make in a career as you get older, which is just that I think you develop a different type of determination when you get older. I mean, I think you learn how to do the things you need to do, and you develop hopefully more discipline, and
measured discipline too is my what I'm starting to
exactly
measured discipline. Yeah. I was just talking with somebody today, and they were talking about how they someone told them to stop being so hard on themselves, and that's something that, you know, I had to learn. Because I was just like, oh, if I'm being hard on myself, I equated that with responsibility.
Yes.
And that's a young man's mistake.
Yeah, and the more you punish yourself, the better
you're like, well, I did something today.
Yeah, at least I punished myself, you know.
Right, self-flagellation. So that's the thing.
Johnny Cash can sing a song about it if he wants to. Right. And it was, I agree. I think what happens is you, And I almost every musician I've ever spoken to, my wife was a professional musician. I remember when I was out in California talking to people at the San Francisco Conservatory and all over, most people say, gee, I wish I had learned how to practice better when I was younger and spent less time and knew how to reach that goal.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Spent less time worrying about other things, worrying about the person next to you, all the stuff you worry about. It's not just competitive, though. I think it's. I think I've always thought that maybe it's some sort of mechanism that's built into us to get us to work or something. I don't know. Just this self hatred is like a powerful driving force.
Yeah, I remember I went through a phase a couple of years ago where I really loved reading a lot of David Mamet, you know, the great playwright who wrote Glengarry Glen Ross and the screenplay for The Untouchables. And he's a great thinker about the arts. And, you know, he made it, I mean, he really made it big in the, when he wrote American Buffalo, and Pacino starred in that on Off-Broadway, I believe, in New York in the early 80s. And anyway, so he's a great thinker about art. And he talks about acting. And he really said almost nobody in their right mind goes into acting. And anybody who goes into the performing arts almost goes in with something to prove.
Right.
And I think that there's something, whether it is a broken heart when you were 18 or something, there's something that drives a lot of people, I think particularly to be a soloist, you know. And and I think that there's a sense of almost trying to prove something along the way. And I think when you feel you lose that, in one sense, you get freed up.
Yeah.
When I played a concert a couple of weeks ago out in Long Island, and you know Chris Gotzenberg, don't you? I think you interviewed him.
Of course I did.
Yeah.
He's a friend. Yeah,
he's a great guy. And he started this Legato Foundation out on Long Island.
Just recently.
And the guy has got a lot of energy and is really devoted to trying to keep classical music alive on Long Island, particularly since the closure of the Long Island Symphony Orchestra. And, you know, being a guitarist himself, he sees his first point of focus right now on guitar. So he arranged some concerts for me, which were in-house concerts. And I hadn't played concerts in about a year because when I was in California last year, I had spent a lot of time teaching. And and I was trying to get my chops back because I'd done a lot of academic teaching the years leading up to that. So I wasn't playing a lot of concerts up to then. And I was still trying to keep my repertoire going, but I had to sort of get myself back into it. But I kind of just got to the point before I had to get up and play the first concert, I thought, I don't really care as much. I just want to say something with the playing. I just want to see if I can actually... I know it's going to be a small audience. It's going to be a house concert. And they're going to be, you know, a certain demographic of people, and it's going to be, they'll be enjoying it. But I just want to, you know, I don't really have anything to prove with this. I just want to say something with piece. I got the full choice of the pieces I wanted to play, and I was able to say what I wanted to do with it. And it was exhilarating.
So you went into it without that feeling of like, okay, well, I better do good.
That's it. You know, it wasn't, oh, there's going to be this person from this society here or from that school there or something like that. It was, what are people thinking? Yeah. You know, it's one of those, it just became one that it became purely about the music. And I was able to focus just on the sound of the guitar and saying what I wanted to say with it.
Yeah.
Which is something that it's hard
especially
to...
That's not an experience that happens to a lot of people.
But what I learned pretty quickly is because I was pressed for, and it isn't, I think you're right, it isn't something a lot of people go through, whether it's not being able to play much for a while and then trying to get back to it, or, you know, being put in the situation where you then have to play again.
Mm-hmm.
And the good thing about it, you can sort of feel a little bit like a hero, too. I remember I studied with Robert Guthrie many years ago, my first year at Yale. He was the guitar teacher there before Ben Verdery became the guitar teacher. And I remember asking Robert, what do you do if, say, you show up at a concert really late and you don't have enough time to warm up, and you get called to play this gig and you know you have to step in and do it because it's a good thing to do, and you get it, you know, you want to play the piece or something. He said, you just have to think you're a hero and get in there and do it so something else carries you in a way, too.
Yeah, it's almost like that's what I, you know, when I don't play for a while and I know I'm getting back up, I can almost like turn it into some sort of a myth. You know, like I get up there like a Rocky or something.
Well, I think it's important. Yeah, exactly. You know, you've got to jump up the steps.
Visualization. Yeah, it's right. Real. I mean, Kevin Gallagher always told me I'd struggle with like a hand problem. And he was always just saying, you just got to when you're practicing, just do it with a swagger. You know? And I mean, that's kind of, it sounds like that's kind of what you did. You kind of got up there with like that, the swagger.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's, and it's interesting kind of to hear Kevin.
Perfect word for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I think we have to, because you are delivering something in a way that's outside of most people's experience. You're doing something quite different. Mm-hmm. But you also don't want to think of it. You know, I also think if you kind of
over-romanticize
in a sense, too, you get lost in the role after a while. You know?
Yeah, it's like, you get out there and it's four people and you're like, this is not Rocky. There are six people in the audience. two of them have seen me naked.
Oh God!
So that's the thing, is that, you know. Well, yeah. So, you know, as far as like, yeah, keeping your cool in a situation like that. Did you? So you really felt like you really felt confident in a way that you didn't expect to feel.
Exactly, yeah. But it wasn't even a sense of confidence. It was a sense that this was just the right thing to be doing. Because I think you can also build up.
This is the right thing to be doing. Is a very important thing. To address with people that are struggling with performance issues, is that you have to remember this is the right thing. It's not the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going through your head, like, I shouldn't be doing this. That was my junior recital, I shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. Well, well, that's interesting. What happened there? Was that actually happening while you were performing?
Oh, yeah. No, I remember it very clearly. It was the first real performance, solo performance that I'd given forever. My family was there. It was in Austin. And I remember just being up there and going like, what? I don't want to ever do this again. You know, this feels very bad. Mm-hmm. And thinking, I shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. And then nowadays, when I'm up there, it's more like, oh, no, this is what you need to, this is, you should be doing this. Mm-hmm. This is what people want to do.
Yeah.
This is like part of what a lot of people wish they were doing. And you're doing it.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's a great honor to be doing it, too.
It's a great honor.
I don't remember who said this to me years ago, but it was something to the effect that you also remember you're there also bringing people outside of their everyday world. I mean, even if they have they have very successful lives, or they just have a day-to-day life, and, you know, that's, you know, life might be hard, life might be difficult for them, might be easy, you know. But in a sense, the music is transporting these people, and you have the chance to do that. And the great thing, like, even about this interview, and this is why I was so honored when I was asked to have this conversation, which is that, you know, we live in a world, I think, where people don't really get a chance to have people listen to them. I think people really want to be heard, you know. You just sit around a dinner table. Sometimes it's hard to get a word in edgewise.
You know? No, well, I didn't do this podcast, but I did like another one before this with like some younger dudes, like at this point. 6 years ago, or 10 years ago. And it was, that's what struck me, is the kind of conversation that we were having is not the kind of conversation that I'm going to be having with somebody when I'm distracted at a party or a bar or in an intermission. So that strikes me, just like that, about the medium of the podcast in general.
Yeah.
You know, like you're saying, the people want to be heard.
Yeah, you get that. You're given that space, and when you're the player, whoever it is who's giving the concert, people are going to be quiet for at least a half an hour to an hour and sit down and listen to you deliver something to them and have something to say. And I think that carries a lot of responsibility to some degree, but it's also that people are opening themselves up to hear what you have to say about this music. They're actually going to keep their mouths closed for a while you do something, you know. I mean, the world isn't quite like that, you know. No. And it's a fantastic situation that we're put in.
Yeah, and to think that maybe humans need that more than they care to admit, to be heard and to have their heart heard.
I think the ability to listen. I think the ability to try to get into what the person is trying to say is an exceedingly difficult thing to develop. I think some people have a great talent for it. I think they're able to do it. I think some people can do it quite naturally. I think it can be developed. But I think it's something that you have to develop as a teacher. And, you know, that to me has always been the most important thing if you're teaching one-to-one or a small group or even in a classroom. You have to hear what people are saying to you. You have to be open to it so that you can, because everybody's going to have a different perspective on it and they need a different way of hearing it. There is no one way of doing it, I found. I mean, there are certain principles that you try to develop in terms of playing, but a lot of people are more, you know, some people are more visual, some people are more oral, some people are more, you know, they're more tactile. They need things to be really worked out and worked through. You know, they feel the way the right way to play the instrument is, and you watch them and work with them. So you have to find the way that works best for them. And I think it's part of that system. I think that teaching for so many years helped me to actually become a more confident performer too.
Yeah, sure. Because listen, the idea of listening, and listening is something that comes with age for sure.
I was thinking about that.
Doesn't.
I think sometimes I see people when they get past 80, then it starts to get like, hey, I've been around. I don't need to listen to any of that. I know.
Old men.
Yeah.
Don't even try to get a word in. Just sit and listen. They won't listen.
Yeah. When they're buying their lottery tickets and the delicatessen, you're trying. They're not going to move fast for you.
They're going to talk to you about everything. Price of bananas. But nothing against old people. You guys are cool. All of those of you who are listening to this on your iPhones right now. But as far as, that's the truth. And I mean, you know, like you said, there's no one way to do it, to teach or, you know, to teach. Well, I guess we're talking about teaching, which is great. But there's no one way to do it, and that does involve basically at all times being open to listen.
Listening, yes. And I think sometimes also understanding there might be some situations where there's a person that you're not going to get through to, in a sense. So I think that rarely happens. I think most good guitar teachers I know have always found a way, but there's always one or two, every, you know, 5 or 6 years something comes up. There's a student just doesn't jive with a certain teacher, in a sense. And teachers can get very upset about that in a way too. What did I not do to really get through to a person? But I think it's also letting that kind of thing go too. Some people, you know, it's just like a relationship or something. Some people are better off with other people. Some people are better off with different teachers. But I wanted to get back to the thing you were saying about your recital, because it was interesting about this whole idea with dialogue. Because I was
inner dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember. I mean, when I moved to Scotland many years ago, and I started freelancing there, I did a lot of work with orchestras. I had great opportunities to play with the BBC and Scottish Chamber Orchestra and the Scottish Opera. And I was thinking about this interview you've done with Michael Chapdelaine.
So you were Edinburgh?
No, Glasgow.
Glasgow. Okay.
Actually, Glasgow is more of the cultural center of Scotland than Edinburgh, even though Edinburgh is like the capital city.
I heard people just vomit on the street in Edinburgh.
Well, the same thing in Glasgow, right? it's kind of a national pastime, you know? Cool. And kind of avoiding these is kind of a kind of dance you can do. That's where the Highland Fling comes from, you know, trying to avoid these pats of vomit. Yeah, well, but the, I mean, Glasgow, for the size of the city, I think the population was 650,000. I mean, they had the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. They had the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, mm-hmm. and they had the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland was located there, and they had the opera located there. Now, that was an incredible amount of musical organizations.
And that's all that's
all in one city. You know, they always traveled over to Edinburgh to do concerts, but all of that was located there. So it was a much more vibrant town in terms of new music. But when I started playing there, I started getting a lot of freelance work, but playing in orchestras. And
what year was this?
This was back in 1989.
Okay.
And luckily, I landed in Scotland, in Glasgow, the year it became the European City of Culture. And many American listeners may not know what that is, but the European Union, which that's another issue completely now with Brexit, but the European Union used to elect one city per year and give them quite a lot of money in order to promote the arts. So so every year it's different. And the year I happened to move there, Glasgow got the money and to do that. And so they were just performing venues opening all over the place. They opened up
street,
but you know, concert series and music clubs, you know, had doubled and tripled the amount of concerts they were putting on because they had government funding. So I was fortunate enough to get a lot of concerts and I was able to do a lot of creative things with
the residual ripples that must happen after something like that happens to a city must be wonderful.
Glasgow was remarkable. I mean, I didn't have much experience of Glasgow before.
I'm not trying to change the subject. I'm just thinking about like a large infusion of multinational, you know, monies being funneled into one area for just can completely transform.
In a lot of ways. When I first moved there, I mean, for instance, I found the supermarkets were seemed a bit less well stocked than I remembered in the United States, mm-hmm. but then they got more food in from
more hippie dippy,
more hippie dippy, and more fresh food and other such things. But also Glasgow is very
which
much
back like, then, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. or Brussels sprouts, right?
Oh my goodness!
But the Glasgow is interesting because I was born in Brooklyn. Glasgow was also a shipping town like Brooklyn uh-huh. once was, and I was born in Red Hook, which is where they used to build ships. And a lot of Glasgow reminded me of Brooklyn. You know, same red brick buildings, cobblestone streets of the residual old streets, the same kind of warehouses with the same kind of arches of the red brick in the big warehouses. But it was also having been an industrial city, they used coal to burn for energy for the city. Almost all the buildings were pitch black from residual coal dust. And one thing this infusion of money did for Glasgow is they cleaned all the buildings, and all the beautiful red brick sandstone buildings are now exposed in all of their pre-Victorian glory.
So that didn't get, I guess they didn't get bombed out or whatever.
No, part of Glasgow did get bombed, but Glasgow was bombed because there was a lot of shipbuilding in the Second World War, and there was also a lot of the American troops used to go into Glasgow before they went down through England into, as far as I understand, into mainland Europe for the Second World War. But they did get bombed, but they not as badly as London.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like London is completely rebuilt, right?
Yeah. From guitar to the Second World War, right?
Post war, post war cleanup. But as far as Glasgow, you moved there like in the early 80s, and you were moving from studying with Robert Guthrie at Yale. Is that what you did?
My guitar studies are vast and varied. The reason I play the guitar is because of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be the Beatles,
right?
And I saw them on Ed Sullivan when I lived in Brooklyn, and I remember them being on television live for their first shot in the United States, and then I wanted to play the guitar. But then when I saw Eric Clapton play, I really wanted to play the guitar because that was the sound that was.
When did you see him play?
I saw him on television actually on the Glenn Campbell Show in 1968 when Cream were touring. And Sunshine of Your Love had just become a hit. And I'd never heard the song, and I was blown away by his playing. And I thought, I'd never heard anybody play like that. And that made me want to be a guitarist. But in those days, even though I lived in New York, I lived on Long Island, then moved to Long Island, I didn't find it easy to find a guitar teacher. I mean, it was hard. Maybe because my parents weren't musical. They came from a different type of background. Was that I had to sort of teach myself, work out things off of records and try to figure out, watch people play.
Would you do it on electric or?
On electric, mostly electric. Cool. Well, I played electric in bands, but I worked out most things on a nylon string cheap Sears guitar. I always preferred to practice on an acoustic guitar and then perform on the electric guitar. I didn't like practicing on the electric.
You can't just pick it up and go.
You can't, but also I found it was almost like working out. If you worked on the acoustic, it felt much easier on the electric. So you were fitter. I know, because the strings could bend. Yeah. But I played in rock bands and the like for years, and I thought that was being a serious musician. That's about all I really knew. And then I played in a few rock bands on Long Island, and I played in this fantastic country rock band in the mid-70s that did a lot of Grateful Dead and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, we had, that's that really, my stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You know, New Riders of the Purple Sage.
Yeah, I
wasn't.
Saw
yeah, the, yeah, yeah. I wasn't into that whole English invasion of like Queen and stuff. That went by me, even Led Zeppelin at first, because after the Cream broke up, I didn't really listen to heavy music anymore. I got into more mellow music. But I played in this electric bluegrass band with this incredible fiddle player. And he was also a fantastic guitarist. He was to this day, if I remember correctly, and this was over 30 years ago, and memory can exaggerate or fade things, mm-hmm. but he was one of the best improvisers and technically proficient guitarists I'd ever seen. And he played with a pick.
Yeah.
And I remember asking him, like, how do you do this? Because I was still playing pentatonic scales and, and he said, "Well, I study Indian music. I study Indian music with this great Indian master in the village in New York City. His name is Vasant Rai." I said, "Oh, well, I'd like to meet him sometime. And I went and met him, and I started taking lessons, studying Indian music. And that's when I think I learned what it took to be a musician in terms of practicing, devotion, putting your time, you know, giving yourself up to the music to a certain degree, knowing what it takes, being critical of your playing, knowing what higher standards were, and also being incredibly inspired by this fantastically devoted and creative musician. And that was sort of my first step of being serious about the guitar. So I started listening to different styles.
Well, when he played Indian music, did you, I mean, was he doing a sitar? Or what was he
well, he was a sarodist. Sarod, which is like an Indian lute. It's a fretless guitar. It has a metal neck. And it kind of looks like a lute body, but it has a metal neck, and there's no frets, so there's a lot of, you can play a lot of the microtones and the like quite easily. But and it uses they use a pick, a coconut pick. Yeah, it's this big wedge of a coconut skin or shell, and then it's polished. It's about it's probably about 3 inches long on the top. It's brown, yeah.
It's a rosewood pick,
kind of like that, you know. So it was like coconut wood, the type of coconut shell. I never actually played the sarod though. He also taught Indian music to Westerners by, for instance, we tuned the guitar like a sarod. Mm-hmm. So you changed all the tuning so you could play the ragas and the scales and the modes in the proper fingering that would have been used on a sarod. So
tuned the guitar to
like a sarod,
Indian standard tuning. But you had frets. But you had that sort of
used a pick.
Open tuning.
That's right. That's a way of thinking of it.
Right. Yeah.
Because you have to be able to play drones while you're playing, and then usually with Indian.
When I did open tuning, I just sounded like I was playing a raga.
Yeah. And well, it offers that sound that the sound world, a basis of some type of harmony. But usually, what I learned a lot by studying Indian music was good picking technique, because you have to play very, very fast, and the exercises are, you know, it's like Mahavishnu orchestra stuff that the speed that they expect you to play. And not that I really got that close to it. I got fairly close, but I certainly wouldn't be putting John McLaughlin out of business, that's for sure, or Al Di Meola. But but what it did, also you have to shift a lot, because a lot of the melodies just go up and down the first and second string. So you don't play in one position. You have to keep going up and down the string, which was really good.
To get comfortable.
And I did that for a few years, and I just really learned about a respect for what it took to learn something that deeply.
Yeah.
You know, and then I started listening to classical guitar. I didn't know what classical guitar was. I went into the city and was down in the village, and somebody was selling an Andre Segovia classical guitar LP for 25 cents. So I bought that and started listening to it.
I'm just looking for your water.
My water's right here.
Totally cool. I just want to make sure you have water.
I'm pre-screening it here. It's right behind your screen.
You can totally do it. Okay. You can spill on anything. There's not much. I just wanted to make sure you had your water. You were saying village?
Oh, yeah. So anyway, I found the Segovia record. I bought it for 25 cents and went back to my house and listened to it. It was all scratched. But then I heard a different way of playing, and then I listened to Christopher. I remember hearing Christopher Parkening was a protege of Segovia. I read that in Guitar Player magazine. That was the only magazine in those days. I actually bought like a Christopher Parkening's Greatest Hits album. And when I heard him play the Bach fugue in A minor, the one that's, you know, from the violin sonata in G minor, I was just said, I've got to learn how to do that, you know. So I found a guitar teacher on Long Island who advertised in the Village Voice. I don't know if the Village Voice still exists, but then, you know, he said he had studied with Ray De La Torre, and I had heard of Ray De La Torre. So I started taking lessons with him, and then wanted to... I thought, well, I'd really like to go study in a conservatory or a music school of some sort. And that time I was kind of going to college. I thought I was going to either be an English teacher or a psychologist. And I said, no, I really want to be a musician. So I thought maybe go to Manhattan School of Music or Manus. And I auditioned too early for these places. I mean, I could play the guitar, but I didn't know enough guitar repertoire. So I took another year off and I practiced a lot. And then somebody said, you should audition for Stony Brook University. Is a really great guitar teacher out there, you know. And I lived on Long Island. I lived in Suffolk County then. So, okay, I'll do it, you know. So I went and played for Jerry Willard. He liked my playing, and he took me on as a student. And he was a great teacher. I was exceedingly lucky to be in New York or Suffolk County at that time, being able to get an inexpensive first-rate musical education from this great guitar teacher, really generous, you know, told me how to develop a sound, how to practice. I learned a lot of repertoire in a very short period of time. And the environment there at Stony Brook was fantastic. All great musicology teachers, theory teachers, ear training teachers.
Yeah, the Emerson String Quartet, is like the resident.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing what, you know, I mean...
For a state school?
State school.
Yeah. And I just stumbled upon it. And then there was people like Leo Treitler teaching history and Richard Kramer and the Beaux Arts Trio was out there. And I didn't realize I was getting top class, world class education. To me, it was just some kid from
Brooklyn. Like, school.
Yeah, it's a state school. You know?
Right, right.
But but the thing is, I took it very seriously. I worked very, very hard. I taught while I was in college, in university. And then... and learned my repertoire. Then I decided to try for Yale, and I got in. And I had been Robert Guthrie was the teacher, and he left after a year. He was living in Texas then. I think coming back, he didn't want to relocate.
Yeah, he's still in North Texas. Yeah.
And then,
sorry about the noise. Let me see what that actually said. Oh, see, I would like totally pick it up. Maybe if I turn down the bass. I want to talk more about Robert Guthrie for sure. That kind of does something. All right, we're just going to have a little bit of high-end, folks, wait for the bulldozers to stop. I don't know. You know what they do? They wake me up at 7. This is the first interview that I'm doing in the Greenpoint apartment.
I'm honored.
My bed is right there. If you just stretched your legs out a little bit, you'd be on my bed.
It's a nice bedspread too.
It's a little IKEA action.
Yeah,
that's all. You would know all about that being from Red Hook.
IKEA and actually, I'm probably only a stone's throw from where I lived when I was a kid. So it feels really nice to be back home.
Yeah. So as far as like Robert Guthrie.
Oh, right. Back to Bob.
No, I mean, we don't have to. But it just reminded me to turn the bass back.
Okay.
So that people don't have to listen to us like we're on walkie talkies while they're doing whatever they're doing. Robert Guthrie, like, what was your relationship with him? I mean, it's hard to remember how long he's been around.
Yeah, it was.
I saw him in concert once in the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think he's not running around too much.
No, I got to know Bob Guthrie by my old friend Richie Savino's out in California. Yeah. We were at Stony Brook at the same time. We both have similar backgrounds, Italian American guys. And
yeah, I keep missing him. Yeah, I keep missing.
You got to get Richie. Richie.
I could go back there and get him too when I go back.
And
for Christmas.
I'll next time I speak to Richie, I'll let him know that you're looking for him. He'll find that funny.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm sure you'll enjoy having him on.
Oh, board. Dude, yeah, 100%.
So anyway, Richie was a good friend of mine. He said, "Hey, you know, they're giving this master class out in Queens College, Pete. Why don't we go?" And I said, "Who is Robert Guthrie?" And I was like, you know, so everybody joked, "Oh, is he Woody Guthrie's brother or something?" Like that, you know. So I said, "No, he's a really good guitarist, and he's he also teaches out in Aspen. And maybe you can talk to him about maybe applying if he likes your playing, you know." So I went and played. I went and played the Mozart Variations for him, and I thought he was a terrific teacher, and he seemed to like my playing. I played really well for him. I was really well prepared, and he just knew how to teach how to play the guitar. He talked a lot about the mechanics before a lot of people, even before some of the stuff that's come out later through very famous or very popular guitar methods that are used, about the way one has to feel when they play, how to do workout routines.
Where did he come from?
He used to talk a lot about the Romeros. Now, I don't know what his relationship with the Romeros was. I know he played in Segovia masterclasses. In fact, in one of the Parkening
books. So he's almost like a pre-collegiate guitar guy.
Exactly, yeah. And I think a lot of it's self-taught.
Right, pre-Aaron Shear.
Yeah, pre-Aaron Shear. And I remember I went through the Aaron Shearer books when I first started learning.
Me too.
Had to learn how to do a rest. Your stroke was like a paintbrush, and the knuckle went backwards. And
then he
completely changed all of that in his revised method book.
Yeah.
But
But I just thought, I think I can really learn something from him, and I seemed to, he seemed to like me, and you know, seemed to enjoy working with me. So I went to Aspen, and he was the teacher. Well, Gilia was there for the first part of the summer, and then Bob Guthrie, and we got on really well. And I said, well, you know, do you think I have a chance for Yale? He said, well, put in the application and apply, and we'll see how it works. He said, you know. He said,
just
I think you stand a chance.
Who else is applying.
Yeah, or, that's it. Yeah. No, I wasn't a shoo-in or anything like that.
Yeah.
So that year I got in, and but Rob, you know, we had a pretty good year, and but midway through, I think it just became the traveling might have been too much for Robert, and he was more of a homebody, and he decided to leave Yale. So then they brought in Ben Verdi. They auditioned quite a few people. They brought people in to, you know, to give master classes and the like, and they chose Ben to do it. And so then I did my master's degree. My MMA, well, I went on to the MMA, and then I went to Canada for a while, to the Banff School of Fine Arts, which was a great experience. I got an artist in residency there for a year, which was absolutely fantastic. Then I went back and finished my doctorate. I finished the work for that. But then I got married. I moved to Great Britain. I went to live in Scotland. And then while
so you
I was
got your
Scotland,
doctorate?
No, then I had to go back and finish my doctorate. Mm-hmm. So I finished my doctorate in 1993.
Oh, yeah. With Ben?
With Ben. Yeah.
Oh, how cool.
Which was very cool. He opened up a lot of thinking about my playing and a lot of approaches about sort of freeing up my playing and getting me out of that sort of, you know, I've got to learn a certain way, I've got to learn a certain repertoire. It was very much, he was of that like Leo Brower school and the like, which is be yourself, be who you are, and you know, express what you are through your instrument.
Well, which is something that, yeah. I mean, there's something just at a certain point, if you don't do that, you're just not going to be a healthy player.
Yeah, now you're going to be very neurotic.
Yeah.
It's going to be very unhealthy. And after a certain point, you just can't go on doing that.
No.
You know, it all comes out in the end.
Or if you do, something else is going to take a hit.
Yeah, you know, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, yeah.
Your personality.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of these people that, you know, just no offense, but that's what they do, and that's about it. You know what I mean? It doesn't seem like there's that much. To me, and I'm not talking about guests on the show, really, but... I you know, you do see that situation where somebody's just so like a machine gun, and then personally speaking, there doesn't seem to be that much color going on anywhere else.
I mean, I saw that pretty early on in my career. I had a
you were, because you like me were also starting later.
I started later. When I saw prodigies come along, by the time I was
to get there.
But I also knew that I couldn't be a prodigy. I was too old to be a prodigy. So to try to do that, you know, that'd be like me saying I have blonde hair and blue eyes, which I don't. You know, I can't keep wishing for that. I have to be what I really know how to do. And, you know, and I thought I had a talent for teaching. It was almost like a calling for it. So I always did a lot of that.
You totally have the right personality for it.
And so what I found is I always used to watch it with great curiosity. Used to watch when I saw people entering competition after competition this. And it was like it didn't seem that people got that much further after all of that.
Well, that's 100%.
And that you still had to make a career, you still had to make a living, you still had to pay the mortgage. I mean, I was listening to Michael Chapdelaine's interview last night just to sort of prepare for this interview today. And what he was saying, I mean, he had the case of somebody just putting completely putting a brick wall up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's almost the most horrid case that one could possibly imagine. Yeah. Not any fault of his own. Yes. And I also came to realize people can stop and start your careers just if they want to do that or not. But if you prove yourself as a teacher and as a reliable person and as somebody you can get along, you can work with other people, and you can teach other things. I used to teach a lot of music history and theory. I created a lot of courses and worked on papers with people and published journal articles in music education and on Renaissance music and the like. I just found diversifying was always very interesting, and it just fed into my playing. It made me enjoy my playing because I knew I wasn't going to be that competition winner who was going to nail every single note of the Aranjuez at just short of the speed of light.
Right.
You know, and it just wasn't going to work for me. But people liked other things about what I did, and I finally came to terms with that. And Ben and that kind of teaching helped me kind of find that way through that, because he accepted lots of different
Ben's ways. One of those too.
Yeah.
Ben's not like a competition winner.
Yeah.
And he had to make his own way, and then he was rewarded for it. You know, for that and for
deservedly.
Yes, and for producing.
Yeah.
You know, you listen to all those. What's his ensemble? I forget. what the name of it is. I can't remember it off the hand. But I mean, you know, that kind of you give those things to the art form rather than just, you know, concerts, you know.
And I think what I learned from Ben, which is that be comfortable with yourself, because people like that in a sense too. So Ben, you know, Ben wore fairly outrageous clothing for a concert, a classical guitar performer.
Yes,
you know?
He does.
Yeah, and you know, and
I won't give clothing to him. I won't give him any points. Sorry, Ben. You're the nicest guy in the world. But.
Well, at least it was. I remember
take a step back.
Yeah, I still preferred it over Julian Bream's cap.
He was really big on the collarless. Shirts.
Yeah, that's right.
I could never get behind collarless shirts.
Yeah,
him
yeah.
and Bill Kenningeiser with their collarless shirts.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love both of them.
Yeah,
it's like
yeah. Maybe I just don't have a very good neck. So
I don't want to button it all the way up. I've got a big neck. Everybody else isn't allowed to button it up if I'm not allowed to. Well, now that shit's coming back.
Is it really?
All the kids around here are buttoning their shirts all the
time. Oh, really?
The other day, my girlfriend told me. She goes, I want to see what you look like. She's young. She's younger than me. She goes, I want to see what you look like with it all buttoned up. Buttoned up, and I'm like, they're sitting there like this.
So button up, but no tie.
Yeah, like that. Like
oh,
that.
Right.
Like the comedians in the 80s. Like, what's his name? Anything But Love guy. Richard...
Oh,
you know what I'm talking about.
He was on Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, right.
Okay, right.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they'd wear the jacket, right?
They'd wear a jacket and tie, with a shirt
yeah.
with no
yeah.
tie.
Yeah.
We're off
subject here. We're off topic, right?
Okay. Very sorry, Ben. Better.
Anyway, no, so that was, you know, so I completed my doctorate with Ben, you know, and then I had basically, I mean, what Yale does is you basically have to go off and get your own career after that. You know, that's part of getting the DMA. And I worked really hard. I mean, I was kind of lucky because when I went to Glasgow, there wasn't a big guitar scene there, so I was able to get a lot of things going. I started two guitar festivals there. You know, I got a lot of playing work. I got to play fantastic pieces. Like, I got to play Mandolin and Agon by Stravinsky and Mahler symphonies and really major works with top players. And getting back to what we were saying about... attitude or feeling about when you get on and play. Mm-hmm. One thing I learned is these players just sit up and they stand up and they play it. Mm-hmm. It's not like this big thing. It's not like, you know, in the guitar world, it's like, oh, you're playing the chaconne. And people's voices sort of get...
Well,
like,
we're all trained as soloists,
yeah.
so we
yeah.
all bring that sort of intensity to it.
And all these people... I mean, I remember going to my first recording session with the BBC and, you know, basically being quite frightened, you know, because I think I overextended myself slightly by saying I could really handle the mandolin part to the Stravinsky piece, you know, and which was 12 tones, so it was quite virtuosic at times.
Wow.
So I practiced it really hard. I got the music ahead of time and had really learned my part like a soloist, right?
Right.
So I go in there and everybody in the harp solo was just as hard and all. Everybody's just sort of like, oh, is this the music? And they like open it up and they sight read it and stuff, and you know, people just take it. They knew how to conserve their energy for the big performance.
They know how to conserve their energy.
Yeah. And, you know, they'd rehearse, they'd give about, they'd give like 50%, but that sounds pejorative. They knew that they couldn't give it all the time, or else they couldn't give it when it was really needed. And I learned from watching...
What does pejorative mean? I love that word. What does that mean?
It means in a negative way, you're putting it down.
I'm sorry, go on.
So in a, and so I'd even watch the leader of the orchestra, which, you know, they have to be the most active, the violinist, but they know when to calm down and then step out and take it and then, you know, use their energy in the right way.
Yeah.
But I do remember, I mean, one thing I didn't know the BBC had done, well, I don't know if they still do it, but in those days, they used to record the rehearsals. Then when you had the live performance, then if something didn't go right in the live performance, they would paste in bits of the rehearsal. So they had stuff in the can already to if they were going to broadcast it later on. So what they did, they had to check balance. And I had never been in a BBC orchestra before. I'd never been in a professional orchestra before. They said, okay, well, since we have to test the balance, we want to start with the quietest instrument. So mandolin, will you start with the solo in such and such movement? And there's like 88 first-rate players sitting around me, and they're like, watching me play all on my own, you know. Uh-huh. And that was something about learning about focusing in a sense too, and knowing how to not only, this wasn't playing for the audience, this was playing for other musicians.
Yeah.
And in a way that showing, you know, to being able to focus in a way that you just had to do the job as it was there It wasn't about your ego or anything. It was about getting it done so then everything else could work around that, because they were just looking at a sound check. It wasn't about your playing. It was a sound check,
yeah.
You know. But it was a really interesting experience, because I found when I was always preparing as a soloist in college, you know, we got, you know, there was days leading up and you didn't talk to people, yeah. And, you know, you had to be prepared and you had to have the water right and, you know, you didn't answer phone calls. And, you know, you were a prima donna. And you get out there and, man, it's like you just have to get out there and do it. And it's...
You got to do it often, too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they do.
Yeah. And I would day. I would think if guitarists could get that chance to do that kind of thing more often, I think it would help the perspective about playing their own solo repertoire. I think it would make it easier. I think you'd learn how to listen more. And I think also you would also be exposed to a lot. The best exposure to great repertoire is to actually play it. And when you're inside there doing it. I mean, I remember years ago I did the Barber of Seville, which had a very small guitar part in it, but very exposed. So it's a bit scary.
Yeah.
Not necessarily difficult. But what happens is the whole orchestra stops after 15 minutes. Then you play. And then you have to accompany the tenor, right? So...
That's frightening.
That's, and you know, so you, again, but it you develop a different type of nerve, yeah, for something, yeah, like this, and preparation. But sitting in the pit and listening to him rehearse Rossini hour after hour, I felt like I then knew more about Giuliani. I understand more about the Rossiniana by being involved and, yeah, hearing all the parts and playing it and seeing it acted out and being. I like the involvement. You know, I guess you should learn by listening to the record.
But he was the cellist, wasn't he?
Well, Giuliani did play cello in orchestras. I suppose he played with Bach. Played with in Beethoven's orchestras. Yeah. That's the rumor. But Giuliani did.
So he was into it. He was in the middle of all that shit.
In the middle of all that, but he also did collaborate with Rossini. Of course, the Rossiniana and the Grand Overture is just in the style of Rossini.
Yeah, right.
And to understand that vocal style that you have to put forward, yeah, on the guitar, which is very hard. I think it's some of the hardest things to make work on the guitar, is being involved in it and really playing it where you're not doing it as a soloist makes you really absorb it. I think you learn it by absorption.
It makes it more fun to play, too.
That's the key word, fun.
Yeah, the lightness of Giuliani.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and that's what Rossini is.
Soar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting because Soar. I was thinking about Giuliani and Soar on the way here.
And I mean, say lightness is the wrong word. Playfulness.
Yeah.
But you know, Soar doesn't play fun like Giuliani. I think Giuliani is just very fun.
Yeah.
And very. I don't want to say. I think I said it well, and then I kept on going. And now I'm saying it bad.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think...
Soar is very rich.
Soar is rich. I think Soar is just so much more worried about... was more concerned about good voice leading and making sure he followed all the rules. Where with Giuliani of parallel fifths and octaves and stuff, he doesn't really seem to care.
Yeah,
but it's more about texture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, Soar... I think the only time Soar really got funny was that this was in Etude number 12. To me, that was sound like people laughing. Or, you know, Beethoven, 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 Beethoven.
I wonder if it was a funnier person.
It'd be great. Yeah, they should be on a stand-up comedy routine or something. You know? X Factor or something like that.
And then Carcassi is like just a total ham. He's like the funniest guy you've ever seen in your life.
Who would be more droll, right? You know, who's going to spin the place? Who's going to get the pie in the face, right?
Right.
Yeah, Carcassi. Well, I think
he's probably actually the droll one.
Yeah, he's only got
pedantic, and he's like,
I've only got 25 jokes, you know. That's all anybody knows, right?
Yeah.
What about Carulli? I wonder what his sense of humor would be like.
I don't know. He's Italian. Yeah. They're all Italian, right? So they're all, I don't know. I would assume they're all kind of like fun.
Yeah, that's Well, no, Soar was a Spaniard.
Oh, that's right.
Maybe, yeah, but then again, he was more serious probably. Ooh. Yeah.
Who knows? But this is great. We're just getting racially profiled. People have been dead for 200 years.
We may get banned for what we're talking about.
Yeah, not today. Not today. I wouldn't be celebrated. They'll be build statues of us.
That's right. We'll be elected.
With the current guy.
We won't go there.
But as far as that learning that from playing with those different orchestras. I mean, that's the thing is you moved out there. You moved out there. Did you just move out there cold, or was anybody else out there? Was David Russell out there? Was anybody?
No, David Russell had left Scotland years before that. He lived in Spain.
He lived in Spain. He's always been in Spain, right?
And So how did you get in with all these people? Well, it was
Nobody just moves to a country and goes to a place with all the best orchestras.
I was very lucky, and I did have some connections in that. My wife, who's English, was. We had lived in London for a little while, and then she got a job with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, and so we moved up there. And so I got to know people. So that helped me get some concerts. I have to say, it does help to know people.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't have management. I never have had management. Mm-hmm. I didn't have management then. But I got to know people, and they said, "Oh, call this person, call that person." But also, I mean, when it came to working with the BBC and other such places, I was kind of the new kid on the block. I just did cold calling. I just sent out my CV and my resume and said, "I can do this. I can do that."
Back then, you could get in. Yeah.
So they just. And sometimes it's just a matter of getting the timing right. In fact, what I used to do...
Yeah, it totally is, by the way.
I used to look through the programs for the year and see which ones had mandolin or guitar and banjo.
I'd write
to them and say, "Oh, well, I see you have a Stravinsky piece with mandolin. I play mandolin. Would you be happy to have it?" And quite often the orchestral manager just needs somebody. Unless they already have a list, or somebody might have just left the city who was doing it for years. "Okay, yeah, please come in." I remember getting called the day of a recording with Willard White, the great baritone. They were doing "I Got Plenty of Nuttin'."
So you play a lot of mandolin.
Yeah, and banjo. Mm-hmm. Not so much anymore, but I played a lot of mandolin and electric guitar and bass guitar. But I remember getting called on the a couple of hours before they were going to do a recording, because they didn't realize that this particular song had banjo in it, and they just needed to find a banjo player. So basically they said, "Can you do it?" And I said, "Yes." And then I learned how to do it in the next few hours, and then showed up and played it, you know.
Oh, cool.
So you learn all the tricks.
Yeah.
So what I did is I did a lot of cold calling, and they there weren't that many all-round players in the city at that time. So
and
I got
balls to diversify, too, it sounds like.
I wanted to do it because the one thing I always found not as satisfying about playing classical guitar, and I got into classical guitar because I loved it and I was passionate about it, and I found it, you know, kind of a way of connecting on a very basic level. But I always loved playing in bands. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to play guitar was I wanted to be the Beatles. You know, so I wanted to play with other guys and people and ladies who wanted to make music, and we could make music and talk about it and then talk about it afterwards. And to me, playing in these big bands was just a fantastic opportunity. I loved it. It was very different. Playing in a symphony orchestra is a very different sense rhythmically than playing in a small band. Very different. You develop a completely different sense of pulse than you do when you play solo. And it really helped my solo playing in terms of that. So I learned a lot. Everything was done basically cold. I mean, I know there are other ways that people learn. Sometimes when they play shows, they go in depth, they sit in for a little while, but I just went in and did it, and sort of I kind of school of hard knocks way of doing it. But
you did it. That's the way they do it.
Yeah.
And you learned that. You were like, I'm going to adopt the way that these orchestra players, I'm not going to ruin my life for a month because I have to make $200 on the 15th of December.
Yeah.
You know, which is our approach.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you get a good orchestral gig, it pays usually more money than playing a solo concert.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you do when I played in
Money to Burn.
Orchestras. It was the opera Moses and Aaron by Schoenberg, which I had always loved.
Yeah.
And they had decided the BBC Symphony Orchestra was going to do it to open the Edinburgh Festival in 1990. And it was a major mandolin part in that. But also, because the production was so huge, rehearsals went on for weeks. Yeah. So I got paid a principal rate for weeks and weeks, which was kind of really nice, you know, to actually get a bit of a salary for going to rehearsals.
Yeah, you feel like a human being.
You feel like, that's it. And you feel like you're, and that's quite an unusual feeling as a youth,
as a classical workforce. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, I was thinking about when you were talking to some other teachers about, and some of them were saying how much they love teaching people who are not classical guitar majors, people who are doctors and lawyers, and these people really do not work the amount of hours that musicians work. You know, they don't.
No.
You know, and they have a different type of pressure. Nobody will ever know. And it's one of those things I don't think people realize that, you know, you have to maybe.
You can tell a loved one. You can tell somebody you care about. You can say, like, I practiced for, what would you do? I practiced and then I went to the, you know, gym. And, oh, okay. But they don't really understand the physical implications of practicing for 4 or 5 or 6 hours.
Oh, when you have a
concert coming up?
Yeah. And then particularly when you're younger, the sort of compulsion that goes into it too. Oh, I've got my bachelor's degree recital, you know. Anything less than 12 hours a day isn't enough, or something like that. You know, it's this mythical idea too that we're giving in to something like that. Yeah. Like we said earlier on, that somehow it makes you a better person or a better player or something. It's tied up in personality in a lot of ways. And
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. No, go ahead.
No, I want to stay on this as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, this is what I kind of admired. I always found. I used to watch lawyers work and accountants and other things, and it didn't seem as stressful. Now, I may be completely wrong. There may be lawyers and other professions listening to this and saying, you're absolutely wrong. Because you know, when we play a concert, basically other people's lives aren't hanging in a balance. It's very egocentric. We're thinking about ourselves. Our careers hang on the balance.
Right.
But the thing is, every single thing we do is a reflection on what we've put into it. You know, it's like, I mean, even a baseball player only has to hit the ball right once every 3 times, and they're considered great. Now, if we could get away with hitting every other third note, imagine how easy our careers would be.
And also, you know, let's face it, nobody's paying you to be here. You drove in here. This is, before you know it, this is a 5-hour commitment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you took a shower.
Yeah.
I did. From what I can tell.
Yeah, I did. I'm all spruced up.
This is work.
You got to make these videos, man. You know?
I know. Well, I don't want to quite do that. Maybe I will now that I lost some weight.
It's all about me. It's all about me.
It is. That's what some of the reviews say. The host makes it all about him. I'm not getting paid enough to not do that. But I had a wonderful. Is there anything else that you have? Of course, tonight this isn't going to come out in time, but you are part of the New York Classical Guitar Society's guitar orchestra. You're going to be performing tonight.
That's right. I have the good fortune of, when I decided to come back to New York, that some positions opened in the New York City Classical Guitar Orchestra, the community orchestra, where they still want ringers in the band to sort of help. To help the ensemble, and me and 3 other people have been chosen to do that. And part of the responsibility is
Joe Parisi's in there, right? Is he in there? Or he was. He's just in the pictures now. Maybe he was the ringer before you were.
Yeah. No, things changed a bit this year. A couple of people have come and gone. Federico Diaz is in it. He's in the first guitar. Excellent.
Yeah, he's going to be doing the solo.
He's doing the solo for the Bach tonight. Yeah. So we've been asked to help each section out, but to carry on other administrative duties. So my job is to do... reach out to do a recruitment, and so we're trying to get people to join. So I'll be playing with them tonight at the Lutheran Church on 94th and Broadway, and it starts at 7 p.m., I believe. And a very good program, 3 works that are written just for guitar orchestra, and then there's 1 transcription by Jason... Gian Reilly's piece will not be on this. Gian Reilly, I think, has been invited to the concert. I don't know if he's going to if he will be there. A piece by Fred Hand, who's your old teacher.
Yeah.
A piece called Mist, which is a very aleatoric work, and I never remember composers' names for some reason. And we're being conducted by Jason, who's a fantastic conductor, totally devoted to getting the orchestra.
Yeah, you were saying you have him on the show.
It would be great to have him on the show. Has a very interesting history with as a person and as a musician, and devoted to making the guitar orchestra really as a way of bringing forth new works for that ensemble. Not just
trying to take it to the next level too.
Trying to take it to the next level. So I've also been, you know, I've been doing a lot of work with the Legato Foundation out on Long Island, and And so that's keeping me busy right now. And
yeah.
So tonight's concert is the one that, and of course, sort of this will go out after the concert.
Why don't we do Chris Gottsenberg a little favor? What's the Legato? We're not doing him a favor.
Okay.
He's doing us a favor.
Legato Foundation is, again, I was fortunate enough to meet Chris.
But he's always supported the show a lot. Yeah. And really been supportive.
Chris is incredibly enthusiastic, a very, very fine musician. Yeah. Lives out on Long Island. I was introduced to him by Jerry Willard. He started this foundation in which he's trying to promote classical music on Long Island by doing house concerts, bringing in artists, paying musicians
a real rate to
play, encouraging them to do teaching and performing gigs in which they are. I'm a teaching artist for them for him right now, and trying to basically set out a good community of support for musicians. Chris worked very, very hard to get where he is, and his is quite a remarkable success story. Yeah. Remarkable success story is how he finally landed on his feet as an established musician, and he's very, very generous in the way he is in helping people. And I would say anybody who can go onto Facebook or look up the Legato Foundation and try to support the foundation any way they can. Chris is working well beyond all levels of protocol to make sure that this gets
always has that.
He always is, and he's a great guy and incredibly supportive.
Yeah, so, well, I'm glad he's doing this. Yeah. I'm glad he found a home there, because, you know. But anyway, so it's been wonderful having you on, Peter. I mean, one of my favorite interviews by far. Seriously, really good.
Thank you very
much. I'm so glad we know each other now. This is like so much fun.
It's been great meeting you, and I hope we stay in touch. But it was
maybe one day we'll hang out in a room that's larger than a dressing room. You know.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Like a restaurant or something.
Maybe a restaurant or a Starbucks. You know?
There is one.
A coffee place, right?
Right.
Or maybe on stage somewhere.
We're way too cool for Starbucks over here. Which makes me sad because all I want is like a peppermint mocha because it's the holiday season. Yeah. Anyway, so happy holidays to you, buddy.
Same to you.
All right.
And thanks for having me on board.
No problem.
All right, guys, this is Peter performing the music of Benjamin Verdery. Now You See It, Now You Don't. Off of his album. What's his album? What are we talking about here? From the Hook to the Something. From the Hook to the Hill, boy. That's the album on iTunes. All right, I'll see you guys next year. That's 2017, baby. Let's do it. Let's just keep this fucking ship sailing. Happy holidays.